So tonight is the speeches. This is the day, the evening, where all our candidates get to put forward their ideas, their platforms, whatever they want to do if they're elected. The ongoing joke on this podcast is that you get 3 minutes, 1 minute for each year. Have fun with that. You probably won't have fun with that, actually, which is why we did this. So if you're listening for the first time, then we'd like to tell you that this is the WFN Pop-Up Podcast, episode number 9, and today we're interviewing Jordan Coble. The whole point of this thing is to make it so that people have a platform beyond that 3 minutes. So maybe it's 10 minutes per year. Who knows? But we need to get our voices out there. We need to move forward in our community in a way that allows our elected officials or potential elected officials to voice exactly what they want to see done in our community, their passions, their projects. Look, we could do this better. We need to do that better. We need to stop doing that. We're going to hear all that today as we talk to Jordan. Wait for it. Jordan, welcome on the show.
Thank you very much for having me there, gentlemen.
How are you doing today?
Oh, a little nervous, a little excited, a little bit of everything.
You wouldn't be the first one to be nervous.
Exactly.
So look, let's just jump right into this. You got your notes right in front of you here. Talk to us about your three things. Let's tackle the first thing. What do you want to see in our community?
Our community is, first and foremost, I just want to say thanks for having me. This is an honor to be here, and I really support this idea of creating another avenue for sharing of perspectives, of ideas, and giving us a better platform to share our platforms, I guess you could say.
Right.
It's really important. But so my first topic that I'd like to discuss and bring to everyone's attention is the recreation or regeneration of our healthy community. And I see this as a community to organization connection, that there has to be some work done to regenerate the positive experiences that we've had in the past in our organization, but guided through the vision of our community members. So we need to reconnect our community with the organization to empower our community members to be able to share their voices, their concerns, their thoughts and ideas, and really make sure that the work that's being done by the people is for the people.
Do you think there's a disconnect right now between the organization and the community?
I think there's been a disconnect all along in our history. It's not a secret that we're a government, you know, and I don't think our ancestors would have ever referred to our community as a government in the past. So there's a disconnect inherently right then and there. But today I feel that there is a little struggle when it comes to ensuring our community members' voices, concerns, and ideas can be heard, understood, and then empowered into action to better our community.
So you're looking to close that gap?
Bridge that gap. I never want to say close anything. It's got to have an open door opportunity. We want to bridge the gap. We want to create that inroad for our community members to feel confident when they come forward, but also remind them that this has to be a two-way conversation. There has to be respect maintained the entire way, and that it has to be solution-oriented. It's not something that where we can just voice our concerns. It's not a sounding board. It's a moving forward board that we need to establish. So that's what I'm hoping for, is just to reconnect our community so that they feel involved, but also want to come work for our nation, you know, want to come work for our community as well. I know that we have plenty of educated individuals, both post-secondary and trades and beyond in our own traditional knowledge, that have a yearning to work for our people, to fulfill their responsibility to our community. And it should be our role of as leaders, but also as community members, to empower those folks to step forward and at least provide them the opportunity to share their education.
Doesn't that create another disconnect, though, to say that we want these people in our communities or in our community who are educated to come work for our community, but at the same time, there's a little bit of a hesitancy there, it sounds as though, to have that dialogue. I know in the past, anybody whose parents have worked for the community or you have, you've experienced that maybe that frustration and that anger that has come up, that's a result of a lot of other things that may or may not have anything to do with you. Hopefully not to do with you, but nonetheless, it can come at you. And I guess the point I'm getting at here is that if we want those people in our community who are educated to come work for our organization, don't we want to hear them unfettered in what they see as a vision for our organization?
Yes, but I'm a strong believer in respectful dialogue. You know, this
is what if it is a respectful dialogue?
Well, then we have to call each other out on that, and that's a two-way street. That comes, I've experienced it as a community member from those in power, and I've unfortunately been young in my younger years and given it as a community member to those same leaders. And so we have to call each other out, you know, and go back. And this is something that I know to be true in our cultural practices of the past, that when we share in these really tough discussions, we always have to start with what we agree upon first. If we can agree that we want a healthier community, well, let's figure out what that healthy community means. Does that mean a safer organization for employees? Does that mean a healthier community in regards to drug and alcohol addictions and awareness and ways to not just react to what's going on, but also help prevent what's taking place?
So are you suggesting like a strategic plan of sorts? Like where you involve community members?
Oh, planning. I think there should be, I don't know if it's a strategic planning retreat or some sort of session, but a way to generate that feedback from the community amazing. Right. You know, we do staff retreats where we have planning sessions where departments go and they plan their next year, 5 years, 10 years sometimes. But we don't do that as a community. And last I heard, we work for the people of this community. And so we should at least empower them to share their voices, their thoughts and concerns. And maybe that's a nice way to start to bridge that gap between the not so positive discussions that'll come forward, the more negative pointed kind of feedback, you know, the concerns that they're experiencing as individuals, the pain that they've gone through.
What if that negative feedback is legitimate?
Then it has to be heard. And I'm not saying, and there's ways to have these discussions where individuals can be heard, where they feel safe to share what they need to share. I feel angry because of this.
Right.
What we want to encourage is, what is your idea for a solution? That's what we need to nurture.
Do you think that either thing is even possible right now with the current confidentiality agreement that's signed by all of our staff, as far as I know?
I think there's going to be a lot of challenge. I'm not going to say anything's impossible. That's how I got to where I am, is being told that it's going to be impossible for you to get the job that I have right now. People said, I worry for you in your future because I don't think there's a job opportunity. But before I graduated, the job came to me.
That's so encouraging.
Yeah. Well, that does not come from our members. That comes from the outside world, right? This is those who do not understand an Indigenous pedagogy or an Indigenous worldview that have told me these things, that it's impossible to get Indigenous pedagogy forward. Right. But I think that Indigenous practice will help foster these healthier discussions. And I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I'm going to say that there's a lot of challenges ahead, and that's, you know, personally, I feel that there's a number of candidates that can help foster that discussion in a healthy way at this point.
Go ahead.
So if you were to get in, you would work on policy surrounding being like openness of employees, especially employees that are members. You'd work on policy to allow them to actually have a voice again, because I'd say right now we've lost that voice to some extent.
They're muted.
Yeah, there's definitely muted. The volumes have been turned down on a number of things. I think there's also the value in my experience as a WFN employee from recreation all the way through the museum. I understand, you know, the museum began before, or the museum didn't even exist when I started in the repository. And so I was able to work within the policy to create a museum, to garner an amazing staff that has brought the museum to where it is today and move it forward to this next step in the museum's evolution. It's policy driven. We didn't skirt around. We didn't, you know, try to beat around the bush. We just said, nope, these are the confines we have to work within. These are the issues we see with the policies. As important as policy is, I also identify that there's red flags with certain policy. There's certain issues that we need to address. But instead of trying to say, well, that's wrong, I'm not going to go that way, well, let's try to fix it. Let's be positive in our approach and solution oriented so that we can be part of that change in that policy to make it who we are as Okanagan people, as West Bank First Nation. Make it a healthier policy, a more inclusive policy, but one that empowers the staff members who have been hired to do a job based on their experiences, who can facilitate the vision of the community.
So I'm going
to
play the devil's advocate for just 1 second, because you had a lot of notes in front of you, so I don't want to belabor this point.
Throw it away now, boys.
Throw it out the window. Get rid of it. There's a scream. Thunk. That's like my cousin when he was a kid. I can't mention names. So look, I don't speak for the community. Jared and I don't speak for the community. That's not the point of this. But we are part of the community. I'm going to say that what I'm about to say is not dissimilar to other community members. You know, I got 2 young kids. You know, my wife works shift work. I'm currently doing my PhD. I have my own consulting business. I have research jobs at the university. I have my hands in all these different areas. And it's just life at this point. And never mind soccer practice, never mind jiu-jitsu, never mind cooking classes for my child, not for me or my wife, just to be clear. You know, Jared works shift work at the mine. He's gone, you know, for a, close to, you know, 2 weeks every month. And I'm sure there's other members out there that are resonating with those statements, being like, yeah, you know, this happens, or, you know, I'm a single parent, or, you know, I have to trade my kids off every now and then. So in terms of what you're saying about getting a community dialogue going to move our, to close the gap or bridge the gap, as you put it, between our community and organization, as one of those busy people, I would say, look, you go do that as a department, but you get paid because that's your job. Mm. So what about me when I am busy working another job to pay my bills? How do I meaningfully engage in that discussion when I'm already so busy? How are you going to facilitate that?
That's going to be the extreme challenge. You know, I'm in the same boat as you are. We're all parents here, and the majority of our community are parents. There are community members. There are helpers. There are many, many different things, and they wear many different hats. Generating that sense of dialogue, you know, this is a good example. You explore as many opportunities as you possibly can. So if you have, you know, and I mentioned the idea of a retreat session. That's why I didn't want to use that word, because that breaks down into one opportunity to plan. I think there has to be consistent dialogue and opportunities for dialogue created so that that feedback can come, I don't want to say at the members' convenience, but encouraging them to participate when they have the opportunity to do so. You know, opening up those dialogues between council and community members, but also bridging, like I said before, bridging the gap between staff and community in a healthy way, a way that is fostered through policy so that...
What kind of mediums, though? What kind of mediums would that be?
Oh, there's plenty of different ways to do it. Personal engagement is who we are. That's where we came from.
Right.
You know, I've been a student of life, a learner. I've understood the values of leadership and different leadership values that certain chiefs have had throughout generations. And the strongest chiefs that have been talked about have been the ones that have been willing to go and meet with the people.
Right,
and
make so sure one-on-one basis.
Is, yeah, exactly.
Right.
So community, personal dialogue is important. Social media is important. I'll be the first to acknowledge that I am very inactive on social media, and that's something I'm more than happy to change if that fosters a better dialogue. Not being afraid to hear the issues of the community, and that is how I got my name, you know, is that I don't say a lack of fear, but that awareness of what fear can be turned into a positive so that you can utilize that energy into a productive manner.
Right.
I just have one last question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we should have a number of members that should be asked about every issue, just a solid number of, you know, one third or a quarter or whatever of the members that have to actually be consulted before something goes through to policy or you know, money, large sums of money are spent? Do you think that there should be an actual number instead of
polling?
Yeah, instead of having like I've seen a couple meetings, I've been there, and it was like 10 people
mm-hmm.
just decided something for the whole community. I happened mm-hmm. to be there, my boss sent me home early or something, and I'm like, oh, there's a meeting in my community.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then we're told, oh, the ones who show up make the decisions, like, we're like pretty busy,
yeah.
And you know,
it's Tuesday.
Like,
it's Tuesday, and it's 11:30.
I'd like to read to my kids.
Yeah.
The fact they're doing live feeds, like, how do you get a voice in through the live feed if you're attending through Facebook, if right. you're living in Texas? So there are challenges to that. I think this is something that the community is going to have to decide for themselves. And this is where leadership has to take that turn of saying, yes, I'll be your leader. But sometimes being a leader means I'm going to sit back, listen, and just help guide the process, but be led by the community.
So it's about creating those spaces for the community to really guide this process.
Exactly. Because I understand the approach of if you have to be present to be accountable. You know what I mean? I understand that. But like you said, we are busy people. We live in a generation where you're not just working a full-time job. Sometimes you're working many full-time jobs just to make ends meet. And then you're even struggling to do that, let alone make time to attend a meeting and cast your vote when it needs to be made. So we need to listen to the people as to what the community feels is the best approach moving forward. Is there a specific number? Is there a percentage of the community that should be consulted first and foremost? Maybe. But we've also seen through self-government, the self-government process, how that hasn't, what the issues were with that. In the very first two referendums with self-government, we didn't have the proper turnout. We'd lost the votes. We didn't become self-governing until the government changed the rules by saying instead of having 50% plus one of the community, 50% plus one of those who vote. And that was the major determining factor for us becoming self-government. I am a strong supporter of self-government today. I definitely acknowledge, like I said before, it turned us into a government, which is away from our traditional ways, but it helped foster a better relationship through our intergovernmental relationship between the province and the feds. And so there's positives to that. So there's pitfalls in approaching it by saying you have to have 50% plus one. So we have to be mindful of that. But it's about that open and clear communication, letting the membership know what each factor means. If we go this way, here's the issues, here's the benefits. And if we go this way, here's the issues and here's the benefits. Now let's have a healthy discussion.
Well, that comes down to consultation.
Maybe. Exactly. And the other thing is that this isn't going to be something that we can do within the first month. This is something that has to be done throughout process, throughout time, throughout maybe multiple terms to establish a true, strong foundation
for us going forward. Yeah, and it has to start somewhere too.
Testing and experimenting.
You have to start
somewhere. Oh, we got this many. I mean, we're a perfect example right here.
Or 2 years goes by and you're like, we were thinking about it. We'd like to do it. We're still talking about it.
Yeah.
That is problematic. Jordan, we're going to move on to the next thing. Yeah, we're having great dialogue here. And we want to save time for all your points. So why don't you tell us about your second point you'd like to discuss with us?
My second point is about sustainable growth and development. And this goes, again, multiple levels, multiple layers. I do think sustainable growth and development does include renewable energies. I do believe that the world's way of utilizing resources is changing. We have to not just adapt to these changes, we have to be at the forefront of these changes as Indigenous peoples. Moving towards renewable energies is a healthy approach to regain our sense of culture, our sense of pride, and our sense of ancestry. You know, this is what our people fought for way back in the day.
Do you think we should keep logging?
Logging is not a sustainable practice at the moment. I do believe that there's going to be restraints. I do believe that it's. I don't want to say it's a dying industry. It's a struggling industry.
It's dying.
Okay, you guys said it. I didn't say it. But you check Castanet. See which mills are closing.
Yeah.
And it's happening right around us. So I do not think logging is the most sustainable approach to development. I believe that there's many options for us to consider. But there's also, just like the debate about, you know, finding enough feedback for our membership, same idea. You know, moving towards renewable energies, there's cost to that. There's investments that have to be made, but there also has to be actual environment considerations. Where do we start? We start with what we already have. We started with wind farms. I think that's a good beginning.
But we don't own that, though.
We don't own it, but it doesn't mean that we can't start working towards something that we can own, that we can generate through our own means, through our own source revenues, and institute to better our community, to benefit our community. And starting with our own school was a great idea. Implementing the solar panels on the school, brilliant step forward towards renewable energies.
Do you think we should have done that with community services?
I think we should do that with all future facilities and transition our existing facilities into something that is a renewable resource.
Right.
If it is beneficial to the environment. I do know that not everything that is labeled as a renewable energy comes from renewable resources, and so you have to be mindful as to what the true costs, not just financial but environmental costs, are.
So you don't think we should have a nuclear power plant on the res?
I don't think nuclear power is probably the safest bet. It's same answer I gave you before. I'm not gonna write off anything, but at the same time, nuclear power is not my preferred avenue of renewable energies. I'm thinking more towards solar, more towards wind. Those types of energies is what I'm thinking at this moment. But also going back to our traditional practices, you know, with the legalization of cannabis, well, there's an opportunity to, you know, we kind of missed the boat on opening our own, you know, dispensaries here within our community, which is, it is what it is. I'm not going to mention, not talk about that too much, but there is an opportunity to reclaim other products that come from cannabis related materials, hemp products that we can start to generate based on our traditional knowledges. You know, we traditionally were rope makers. We made that out of spetzen, and that is made out of hemp rope. And so we can go back to what made us who we were in the past, that made us recognizable as our strong nation, and utilize those small little gifts of the earth to provide a healthier, more sustainable future for our future generations, and turn us away from being so dependent on things like logging.
Do you want, just as a quick side, Jordan, do you want to explain that quickly? Because our listeners are probably thinking that we had like quite literally hemp plants.
No. Yeah, that's not the case. Everything that we did, so we were agriculturalists, but we followed natural law. There was Our people were knowledgeable. They were experts related to harvesting, to gathering, to hunting. They knew exactly where, when, and how to harvest resources. We knew where things like spitzen, the dogbane, was available.
That's a shrub.
It's a plant. Yeah, it's a shrub. It's a plant that grows near wetlands and wet areas. And so you harvest that. It could be a very dangerous plant, so you can't just pick it when you feel like it. You have to be respectful of the plant itself, respectful of the culture. And that's where I really truly believe this idea of sustainable growth and development also includes the idea of investing in what we know to be true as Okanagan people, investing in our knowledge keepers and our practitioners, so that future generations can go back and say, we still maintain that aspect of mentorship. We had one person who knew how to harvest spitzen properly. He passed that on to his children or nephews or nieces, and that got passed on. And now we have an industry of hemp products or hemp paper or whatever it might be, something that's, like I said, more sustainable than logging at the moment. So the sustainable planning and development, as I just mentioned, it also includes employment. We have to make sure that when we invest in our people, our culture, our knowledge, that we're empowering our people to learn that knowledge. I'm very saddened through my experience with culture. I don't like to brag, but I'm sought after for advice once in a while. And the worst part is when you have young people come up to you who were denied the opportunity to learn or express themselves or share what they learn or told they were doing it wrong. And it breaks my heart when I see our young people more inclined to identify with their other nation that isn't Okanagan, even though they live here in West Bank. That breaks my heart, and we need to address that as a community. We have to be way more inclusive, way more respectful of each other, and celebrate each other's gifts, and understand that culture is not just drumming, singing, language. Culture is our environment around us, what shapes us, what we know to be true, and what shapes us today, unfortunately, isn't the natural terrain that our ancestors celebrated and protected. It's the urban centers that surround us. It's our neighbors that surround us. And so we have to be able to move with the times, move with the changes, but instill that foundation of traditional practices, traditional knowledge.
How does that relate to policy, though? Like, look, obviously culture is important. My degree is focused on culture. Mm-hmm. You live in that space of cultural knowledge. Mm-hmm. So I know the importance of it. But in terms of policy, how does that influence your policy if you were to be elected?
So policy, that's where my strength is blending and bridging the gap between culture and policy. Creating that awareness for our employees to understand who they are working for. When we say you're working for the members, it doesn't just mean the 860 WFN members that we have in our community. It doesn't just mean the other 10,000 non-members that live in our community as well. It includes the natural landscape around us, the natural terrain around us. And so creating that opportunity for education to be shared from multiple perspectives so that our staff understand what it means to work for the community, and turning that into policy, saying things like, if you're working for development services, well, what does that truly mean? What does it mean to fall under Chief Saskatoon Berry? What is Chief Sia in our nation?
Should we develop our land base? Based on that, in terms of policy, we have all this land base. There's a lot of our candidates have said, like, look, we need to develop this land for housing. We need to do this over here to this piece of land. And it seems to be I don't want to step ahead of myself, but it seems to be there's this mentality that maybe not the whole community has adopted, but that some have adopted that, like, if there's a land and it's quote-unquote empty, terra nullius, then let's develop it yesterday.
Yeah, I'm not a supporter of that idea of empty land. In many ways, I miss our empty lands. I miss the West Bank of the old. I miss where I grew up in Hoaxmanik and IR-10 there. I miss walking up on the other side of the highway and hearing porcupines and seeing the wilderness. That wasn't barren, empty land to me. That was many different things. It was definitely not barren and empty. But we have to claim place. We have to claim space. So we have to be present in these certain areas. So places like Gallagher's, I don't think it's in our best interest at the moment to turn it into housing for many different reasons. Main reason, infrastructure costs. I just built my house. I brought a sewer line across a creek.
It's expensive.
Did you have to
bore underneath?
I had to bore. And so if I knew the true cost of what that was actually going to come out to, I might not have built my house. So imagining what that will take to, and the cost that will take to, and the destruction that will have to happen if we bring services from existing services near Gallagher's to our Gallagher's property in the millions, easily. So is it in our best interest to develop in housing or to go towards a more traditional sense of ownership, of stewardship? Mm-hmm. I think that's a better word for it as opposed to ownership. But claiming that place, being present so that no one else is there ruining those lands for us.
What could we do with Gallagher's?
Oh, there's lots of opportunities with Gallagher's.
You perked up there, so tell us.
Yeah, no, I love it. So Gallagher's has lots of opportunity. It's a truly, I don't want to say pristine, it is touched. There's people that visit it all the time. But yeah, it's as natural as it can almost get while still being only 5 minutes out of town. I think there's excellent opportunities for more of a traditional reclamation of that space. I visited that area with knowledge keepers in the past, and we've talked about how it may and most likely was used in the past, and reinvigorating that so that our community members, and even, you know, turn it into a little bit of a tourism model that celebrates our culture, not sells our culture, not sells it out, but celebrates who we were of the past and unearth that deep knowledge of connection to place, that it wasn't just we just lived there because it was easy to build or whatever. No, we live there for a reason. And now let's talk about those reasons.
Connecting that, right?
Yeah.
No, but I appreciate that.
What would you do about housing going forward? That's one of our largest land bases, but I know we have parcels around West Bank as well.
Yeah.
Still probably a little bit short on the West Bank itself land base.
Yeah.
What would you do going forward to ensure housing for your
housing membership? Well, housing and homelessness, those are issues that are of great concern. I know as much land as we think we have, we don't have very much.
Yeah.
And so
should we get more?
More land, of course. Getting more land is in our best interest to do so. How we go about that, I think, has to be driven by the community. We've done land exchanges with the bridge exchange in the past, and that's acquired us more land out near the airport, in the cusp area. So we've been able to grow our lands in certain areas, but our housing needs have to diversify. Not everyone needs a giant house where you're raising three kids. Some elders want a smaller home where they can maintain that home and maintain their sense of independency. While still being provided the services they need. And so there's certain housing needs that need to be connected to our services that we provide through our health and wellness and community services space. But we also need to support students. If we have lands over by the airport, why can't we do a mixed residential, mixed commercial space out there so students can live near or on campus,
right,
have the amenities right below them, and have that safety of feeling connected to the community because that space has been developed for them. And so, but there's also everything in between, you know, emerging families who maybe you're just starting to find each other's love and maybe are thinking about a family and you want to be able to plan for that growth. Those who already have that family or mixed families and you have to accommodate for that growth. And so there's many different needs. But I also believe that we can't keep spanning out. We kind of have to start building up as well. And so as reluctant as I am to say that we need to build high rises or anything like that, we do need to start thinking about how to maximize housing space and provide many different options for the many variable housing issues that we face today.
Just for our listeners out there, to give you a little bit of perspective on reserve land in Canada, if you were to take all the reserve land in Canada and bunch it all together, it would fit into half of the Navajo Reserve in the United States. So just one Indigenous nation in the States, all the reserve land in Canada, every band, every res, fits into half of the Navajo Reserve. So that gives you perspective in terms of land base, in terms of what WFN has and what we're working with and why it's a topic for conversation.
Mm-hmm. But I also know that there's special interests, things like ranches. You know, we came from a ranching community. I used to ride horses down where Kelly O'Brien's is. I love that as a child. It was a really important part of my upbringing. And I know we have many members that are interested in bringing that forward. And so we have to at least accommodate that discussion and see if it is something that's viable, see if it's something that we can maybe either turn into a business, an industry, or just something that reinvigorates that spirit of ranching in our community as well. There's many different needs.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, right? There's these aspects that live within our DNA, you could almost say, quite literally, and we don't have those things anymore. We had Brian on today, and Brian was talking, joking about how him and my dad, when they were kids, because they were quite literally raised together, would race to the horses every morning because there was only two. I grew up and I saw my dad ride a horse once when I was a kid, and it was great. And I was like, whoa, dad can ride a horse. And that was it, because there's no space in terms of what I'm aware of that's continually facilitated that aspect of who we are as Indigenous people.
we're running to 30 minutes. Yeah. My next topic.
On to the third point. We did tell Jordan we're not editing, so I'm sure you all heard that. Yeah, go ahead, give your third topic.
All right, third topic for me is something that's true to my heart, is language, culture, and education. I'm a language learner. I'm a language speaker. I've dedicated my life to understanding every aspect of language that we have in our nation, throughout our nation. Like I said before, that aspect of culture that denies our young people access to this knowledge, the sense of pride that comes with this knowledge, and that sense of empowerment that comes with this knowledge is important. And I think we need to foster that. And I'm a living example of putting my money where my mouth is. I made sure that because I value language so much, I went and took the time to learn it. I sacrificed a lot to get to where I am today, but I also had to navigate through what I call language politics to make sure that I'm moving forward in a respectful way that's supported by our language speakers, our knowledge keepers, and our young people who hopefully will want to learn the language as well. But culture to me is, and this is again, it's very important for me to understand, for everyone to understand, my perspective of culture is not just about what we wear, what we're singing, what we're drumming. It's about the environment that we create and how we nurture inclusiveness within our community. And so when I talk about culture, it's not about who knows more about plants and medicines. It's about how we share that knowledge so that we can all benefit from that. It's something that has to be inclusive, opened up, and celebrated. And I think there's an opportunity through Indigenous tourism to support culture and language revitalization through supporting our artisans, our language speakers, our cultural practitioners, and providing them a little bit of an income so that they can be who they are and love who they are, be proud of who they are. And that education goes beyond post-secondary education. It goes beyond trades. It goes beyond everything. It goes into how we share what we know. I am a product of a community that raised me. I have a loving family and great parents, and I take pride in representing my family. But more than that, I was raised by this community. I was blessed by many knowledge keepers, many language speakers who shared their gift with me and encouraged me to keep going despite the struggles. And I grew up with borrowed aunties, borrowed uncles, borrowed grandparents, you know? And so I am who I am because people's willingness to share with me, and I want to return that gift to our community to share what I have with them. Not saying I know more than anyone, but just saying I have some good perspectives.
What kind of policy would you create for our school for language and culture? That's always been a big topic, and I know that's, you know, big part of your passion. Yes. Education. What does that look like?
I feel we need way more language resources, way more.
How do we do that?
We got to hire more staff members, more community members, more nation members who are willing to share, open up, and be a positive role model for our children. I love our school. I'm one of the original attendees of the West Bank Indian Band School, and I take a lot of pride in carrying that forward. But I also know that, you know, Maynard and Grouse can't do it themselves. I know we're not supposed to name names, but those are the two people that have been
responsible. Our language teachers can't do it themselves.
Can't do it themselves. They need support. You know, we can't have one teacher trying to manage an entire class while trying to focus on teaching language. We need more support for those folks. But we also need to open up the understanding that culture is something that is very broad. There's many different perspectives into what culture is, and that there's many opportunities to celebrate the gifts of those who don't even feel that they're connected to our culture, but have something to offer through art, through carvings, through baseball and sport. You know, there's a lot of values you learn from those that are directly connected to what I feel is our foundational aspects of culture. And so that needs to be nurtured. There has to be more understanding and more openness to provide more opportunities to learn on many different levels. And this includes language, it includes cultural practices. We need formal classes. I attended the 4-year Language House course, which I'm very proud of. But we need to provide that in our own community. Why isn't there a Language House in our community? Why wasn't that supported moving forward? I know that there was a plan.
How do we support the teachers in the school to do that?
By providing them the actual support, the resources that they need. It also requires that support from community members to acknowledge not every staff member in the organization or the school come from our community. Okay, that's a reality. As much as it would be great to say we have 100% WFN run and operated spaces, the reality is we don't. And so instead of trying to fight against them, we need to work with them and make them feel included, that they have something to offer from where they came from. Their experience, they're teachers, you know, they have degrees. Some of them are even gone beyond that. That is something that's of value to us, and we need to support that. But we also have community members that have pursued education degrees that could offer some guidance as well. And so we need to, again, bridge that gap in between. I don't want to say money is the answer, but hiring more people to be able to do the job, it's a good step forward.
Yeah, I don't know anyone with an education degree, that's certainly something to move forward with. Jordan, we're almost running out of time. This is I hate to cut you off on that very passionate speech you had there. We have a couple questions we want to ask, I guess, to finish up. Jared, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I've just been asking pretty much all of the candidates on. I think we actually missed one, I realized today. But I've been asking about what you'll do during your time in office if you get in, about the overdose deaths on the reserve, mm-hmm. use of Bend owned properties for drug houses, loss of property recently because of a drug house. What do you think the best approach is to work on that issue?
Oh man, it's right now. We have to be honest with ourselves. We're in a reactionary phase. Beyond housing, beyond properties, we've lost community members. We've lost brothers. We've lost sisters. We've lost nieces, nephews, you know, parents. And so we have to work collaboratively. This addictions issue, the overdose epidemic that we faced, isn't local to West Bank First Nation. It's experienced in West Kelowna and West Bank, in Kelowna and in the greater urban centers as well. And there's lots of remote First Nation communities that have been facing these same issues for years, generations. We need to swallow a bit of our pride and reach out to them and ask for some help here. What has worked for them? How do they regenerate their culture to create that sense of community connectedness, community responsibility? But we also have to work with our neighboring partners to see what resources they have available that we can utilize. I don't profess to understand addictions. I'm never really got into drugs, and so I don't understand the true effects of it. But I do understand it. It's a disease, but it can be nurtured into a strength. I know so many language speakers who have overcome those challenges and now are those knowledge keepers because of their ability to overcome the challenges of addictions. And so I think culture is an answer, but in many ways, you have to separate those who are facing addictions from the root of those addictions. And so those housing properties that foster drugs and drug addictions, they need to be addressed. We can't pretend they don't exist. Most of us can pinpoint a few of them just by naming them. So we know about them. We need to address that. We need to let everyone know it's not acceptable. It's not welcomed in our community. And we also need to nurture the aspect of healing that needs to go forward and acknowledge this isn't an individual issue. This is a community challenge that we have to face. Addictions isn't one person that's addicted. It's a community that has to overcome this addiction. So we have to nurture that in a more holistic manner.
There's something called the fundamental attribution error. And it's a term in psychology that that was coined towards blaming people personally instead of looking at their contextual place and why they do what they do. So for instance, if you look at someone who is, say, obese, but their entire family and extended family eat McDonald's every single day, are you blaming them or are you not looking at their context? So I think that's certainly something to address. Mm-hmm. Jordan, I'm going to head to one of the last questions here. The last question, because I feel as though you answered the culture aspect in your own notes. What does accountability look like for you if elected as an elected official? And I'm gonna step a little bit further because you may be our last interviewer. So, okay. I wish I would have done this with the others as well. Specifically, what does it look like for you to be accountable in your time, in your responsibilities, and in your... He's not helping me out. I forget the last one.
Finances.
Yeah. Accountability to me starts with honesty. It goes back to our foundational ways of being as children. Only take what you need and use as much of that, whatever it is that you take, as you possibly can. It's all about being honest. I am a hard worker. I work for a living and I will always work for a living. It's been noted to me multiple times that council is not a full-time position, and I think that's wrong. I think the council position is what you make of it. You want to invest yourself into bettering the community, but you also have to be honest as to, is this actually going to benefit the community and or organization, or is it going to benefit my ego And that's something that you have to swallow right out the front door. And if you get elected, is your ego. You're not doing this for yourself. You're doing this for the membership. And so when it comes to finances, I am very confident that I will be extremely open and transparent with my finances. I'm a very, you can ask all the staff at the museum, a very frugal spender. Even in my own personal life, I don't like to buy things.
Do you think we should get rid of the corporate credit cards?
I have no problem with that. I don't see, you know, I know that there's benefit in being able to generate relationships and garner relationships by sharing lunches, sharing a meal. I think that's part of our traditional culture.
Can't we do that with the P card?
We can definitely do that with the P card. There's definitely ways to work around that. And I don't have an issue by saying, hey, I'm taking so-and-so out for lunch, you know, and being accountable to the membership by saying, and this is why I did it. You know, if you don't like it, that's cool. Let's I won't do it again kind of idea.
But I'm telling you.
But I'm going to be open and upfront about it. But I'm also going to hopefully seek that feedback before those meetings happen, both with community members and staff. You know, if I think, and then this is very hypothetical, if there's an oil and gas company that's going to give WFN $1 million, well, is it in our best interest? Is this really what the community, you know, supports? I'm hoping not. I'm hoping they'd be like, Jordan, don't do that, because that's not where I would really go. But we have to be open and transparent with how we plan on spending some of those dollars and how we are honest with ourselves, what we're taking, and how it is of benefit to the community and the organization moving forward.
Great. Jordan, thanks so much for coming on. Guys, again, we went over time. We're sorry about that. We have some good discussion. Jordan, good luck tonight at the speeches.
Thank you very much.
I hope you got your speech ready to go there. I'm sure you do. And good luck at the ballot box in 2 weeks.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
White, lim lim.
White.